gets our nice white athletic socks all gray before we even hit the court, boy.
Jesus, I took 5 minutes explaining how the key to being even a potential player is to treat the things with just exactly the... Here, let me have this. That books aren't just dropped with a crash like bottles in the trash can. They're placed, guided, with senses on full, feeling the edges, the pressure on the little floor of both hands, fingers, as you bend at the knees with the book, the slight gassy shove as the air on the dusty floor, as the floor's air gets displaced in a soft square that raises no dust, like so. Not like so. Got me? Got it? Well, now, don't be that way. Son, don't be that way now. Don't get all oversensitive on me, son, when all I'm trying to do is help you. Son, Jim, I hate this when you do this. Your chin just disappears into that bow tie when your big old overhung lower lip quivers like that. You look chinless, son, and big-lipped. And that cape of mucus that's coming down in your upper lip, the way it shines, don't, just don't. Ugh, it's revolting, son. You know, you don't want to revolt people. You have to learn to control this sort of oversensitivity to hard truths, this sort of thing. Take and exert some goddamn control is the whole point of what I'm taking this whole entire morning off rehearsal with not one but two vitally urgent auditions looming down my neck so I can show you, planning to let you move the seat back and touch the shift and maybe even drive the Montclair. God knows your feet will reach, right, Jimbo? Jim, hey, why not drive the Montclair? Why not you drive us over, starting today? Pull up by the court, swear today you'll... Here, look.
See how I unscrew it? The cap?
With the soft, very outermost tips of my gnarled fingers, which I wish they were steadier, but I'm exerting control to control my anger at that chin and lip.
And the cape of snot and the way your eyes slant and goggle like some sort of mongoloid child's when you're threatening to cry, but just the very tips of the fingers. Here, the most sensitive parts, the parts bathed in warm oil.
The whorled pads, I feel them singing. And blood, I let them extend further than the warm silver hip flask's cap's very top, down its broadening cone to where the threads around the upraised little circular mouth lie hidden. While with the other warm singing hand, I gently grip the leather holster so I can feel the way the whole flask feels as I guide the cap around on its silver threads. Hear that?
Stop that and listen. You hear that? The sounds of threads moving through well-machined grooves with great care. A smooth barbershop spiral.
My whole hand right through the pads of my fingertips, less
unscrewing here than guiding, persuading, reminding the silver cap's body what it's built to do, machined to do. The silver cap knows, Jim. I know. You know. We've been through this before. Leave the book alone, boy. It's not going anywhere. So, silver cap leaves the flask's mouth's warm grooved lips with just a snick. Hear that? That faintest snick. Not a rasp or a grinding sound or harsh. Not a harsh, brutal Brando-esque rasp of attempted domination, but a snick.
A nuance. There.
Like the, once you've heard it, never mistakable punk of a true hit ball, Jim?
Well, pick it up then if you're afraid of a little dust, Jim. Pick the book up if it's going to make you all goggle-eyed and chinless. Honestly, Jesus, why do I try? I try and try just...
Wanted to introduce you to the broiler's garage and let you drive, maybe, feeling the Montclair's body, taking my time to let you pull up to the courts with the Montclair's shift in a neutral glide and the eight cylinders thrumming and snicking like a healthy heart and the wheels all perfectly flush with the curb, and bring out my good old trusty laundry basket of balls and rackets and towels and flask and my flesh.
White slumped flesh of my flesh who wanted to embark on what I predict right now will be a tennis career that'll put his busted-up, used-up old dad back square in his little place, who wanted to maybe for once be a real boy and learn how to play and have fun and frolic and play around in the unrelieved sunshine this city's so fuck-all famous for, to enjoy it while he can, because did your mother tell you we're moving? That we're moving back to California, finally, this spring? We're moving, son. I'm harking one last attempted time to that celluloid siren's call. I'm giving it the one last total shot a man's obligation to his last waning talent deserves, Jim. We're headed for the big time again, at last, for the first time since she announced she was having you, Jim. Hitting the road, celluloid bound. So say adios to that school and that fluttery little moth of a physics teacher and those slumped, chinless, slide-ruled, wheeling friends of... No, wait, I didn't mean it. I meant, I wanted to tell you now, ahead of time, your mother and I, to give you plenty of notice so you could adjust this time because, oh, you made it so un-misinterpretably clear how this last move to this trailer park upset you so. Didn't you? To a mobile home with chemical toilet and bolts to hold it in place, and widow webs every place you look, and grit settling on everything like dust out here instead of the club staff quarters I got us removed from. Or the house, it was clearly my fault. We couldn't afford anymore. It was my fault. I mean, who else's fault would it be? Am I right? That we moved your big soft body with allegedly not enough notice, and that East Side school you cried over, and that Negro research resource librarian there with the hair out to here, that lady with the upturned nose on tiptoe all the time. I have to tell you, she seemed so consummate East Side Tucsonian, all self-consciously not of this earth's grit, urging us to, quote, nurture your optical knack with physics. With her nose upturned so you could see up in there and on her toes like something skilled overhead had sunk a hook between her big splayed fingerlings' nostrils and were reeling skyward up toward the ether little by little. I bet those heelless pumps are off the floor altogether by now, son. What do you say? Son, what do you think? No, go on. Cry. Don't inhibit yourself, I won't say a word, except it's getting to me less all the time when you do it. I'll just warn you. I think you're overworking the tears and the... It's getting less effective with me each time you use it. Though we know, we both know, don't we, just between you and me, we know it'll always work on your mother, won't it? Never fail. She'll every time take and bend your big head down to her shoulder so it looks obscene. You could see it, pat-patting on your back like she's burping some sort of slumping, oversized, obscene, bow-tied infant with a book straining his pronator teres, crying. Will you do this when you're grown? Will there be episodes like this when you're a man at your own tiller? A citizen of a world that won't go pat-pat, there-there? Will your face crumple and bulge like this when you're 6 1/2 grotesque feet tall? 6'6" plus, like your grandfather, may rotten hell's rubber vacuum when he finally kicks on the 10th tee. And with your flat face and no chin, just like him, on that poor, dumb, patient woman's fragile, wet, snotty, long-suffering shoulder, did I tell you what he did? Did I tell you what he did? How was your age, Jim? Here, take the flask. No, give it here. I was 13 and I'd started to play, well, seriously. I was 12 or 13 and playing for years already, and he'd never been to watch. He'd never come once to where I was playing to watch, or even changed his big, flat expression even once when I brought home a trophy I won. Trophies or a notice in the paper, Tucson native qualifies for national junior championships. He never acknowledged I even existed as I was. Not as I do you, Jim. Not as I take care to bend over backwards, way way out of my way to let you know I see you, recognize you, am aware of you as a body, care about what might go on behind that big flat face bent over a homemade prism. He plays golf. Your grandfather. Your grandpappy. Golf. A golf man. Is my tone communicating the contempt? Billiards on a big table, Jim. A bodiless game of spasmodic flailing and flying sod. A quote, unquote, sport. Huh. Anal rage and checkered berets. This is almost empty. This is just about it, son. What say we rain check this? What say I put the last of this out of its amber misery and we go in and tell her you're not feeling up to snuff enough again, and we're rain checking your first introduction to the game till this weekend, and we'll, head over this weekend and do 2 straight days, both days, and give you a really extensive, intensive intro to, by all appearances, limitless future. Intensive gentleness and bodily care equals great tennis, Jim. We'll go both days and let you plunge right in and get wet all over. It's only $5. The court fee, for 1 lousy hour each day. $5 each day. Don't give it a thought. $10 total for an intensive weekend when we live in a glorified trailer and have to share a garage with 2 DeSotos and what looks like a Model A on blocks, and my Montclair can't afford the kind of oil she deserves. Don't look like that. What's money? Or my rehearsals for the celluloid auditions we're moving 700 miles for, auditions that may well comprise your old dad's last shot at a life with any meaning at all, compared to my son. Right? Am I right? Come here, kid. Come here. Yes, a boy. That's my J-O-I of a guy, of a joy of boy. That's my kid in his body. He never came once, Jim. Not once to watch. Mother never missed a competitive match, of course. Mother came to so many it ceased to mean anything that she came. She became part of the environment. Mothers are like that, huh? As I'm sure you're aware all too well. Am I right? Right? Never came once, kiddo. Never lumbered over all slumped and soft and cast his big, grotesque, long, even at midday shadow at any court I performed on. Till one day, he came. Once. Suddenly, once, without precedent or warning, he came. Oh. I heard him coming long before he hove into view.
He cast a long shadow, Jim.
It was some minor local event. It was some early round local thing of very little consequence in the larger scheme. I was playing some local dandy, the kind with fine equipment and creased white clothing and country club lessons that still can't truly play even, regardless of all the support. You'll find you often have to endure this type of opponent in the first couple rounds. This gleaming, hapless locks of a kid was some client of my father's son. Son of one of his clients. So he came for the client, to put on some sham show of fatherly concern. He wore hat and coat and tie at 95 degrees plus. The client, can't recall the name. There was something canine about his face, I remember, that his kid across the net had inherited. My father wasn't even sweating. I grew up with the man in this town and never once saw him sweat, Jim. I remember he wore a boater and the sort of gregariously plaid uniform professional men had to wear on the weekends then. They sat in the indecisive shade of a scraggly palm, the sort of palm that's just crawling with black widows in the fronds that come down without warning, that hide lying in wait in the heat of midday. They sat on the blanket my mother always brought. My mother, who's dead, and the client. My father stood apart, sometimes in the waving shade, sometimes not, smoking a long filter. Long filters had come into fashion. He never sat on the ground. Not in the American Southwest, he didn't. There was a man with a healthy respect for spiders. And never on the ground under a palm. He knew he was too grotesquely tall and ungainly to stand up in a hurry or roll screaming out of the way in a hurry in case of falling spiders. They've been known to be willing to drop right out of the trees they hide in the daytime, you know. Drop right on you if you're sitting on the ground in the shade. He was no fool, the bastard. A golfer. They all watched. I was right there on the first court. This park no longer exists, Jim. Cars are now parked on what used to be these rough green asphalt courts, shimmering in the heat. They were right there, watching, their heads going back and forth in that windshield wiper way of people watching quality tennis. And was I nervous, young sir, J-O-I? With the one and only himself there in all his wooden glory there, watching, half in and out of the light, expressionless? I was not. I was in my body. My body and I were one. My Wood Wilson from my stack of Wood Wilsons and their trapezoid presses was a sentient expression of my arm, and I felt it singing. And my hand, and they were alive. My well-armed hand was the secretary of my mind, lithe and responsive and
sense a rory, because I knew myself as a body and was fully inside my little child body out there, Jim. I was in my big right arm and scarless legs, safely ensconced, running here and there, my head pounding like a heart, sweat pearls on every limb, running like a veldt creature, leaping, frolicking, striking with maximum economy and minimum effort, my eyes on the ball and the corners both. I was two, three, a couple shots ahead of both me and a hapless canine client's kid, handing the dandy his pampered ass.
It was carnage. It was a scene out of nature in its rawest state, Jim. He should have been there. Kid kept bending over to get his breath. The smoothly economical frolicking I was doing contrasted starkly compared to the heavily jerky way he was being forced to stomp around and lunge. His white knit shirt and name brand shorts were soaked through so you could see the straps of his jock biting into the soft ass I was handing him. He wore a flitty little white visor such as 52-year-old women at country clubs and posh southwestern resorts wear. I was, in a word, deft, considered, prescient. I made him stomp and stagger and lunge. I wanted to humiliate him. The client's long, sharp face was sagging. My father had no face. It was sharply shadowed and then illuminated in the wagging fronds shadow he half stood in, but was wreathed in smoke from the long filters he fancied, long plastic filtered holders, yellowed at the stem, in imitation of the president, as courtiers once spluttered with the king, veiled in shade and then lit smoke. The client didn't know enough to keep quiet. He thought he was at a ball game or something. The client's voice carried.
Our first court was right near the tree they sat under. The client's legs were out in front of them and protruded from the sharp star of frond shade.
His slacks were lattice shadowed from the pattern of the fence his son and I played just behind. He was drinking the lemonade my mother had brought for me. She made it fresh. He said I was good. My father's client did. in that emphasized way that made his voice carry. You know, son?
Good Godfrey and Candesda, old trout, but that lad of yours is good,
unquote. I heard him say it as I ran and whacked and frolicked. And I heard the tall son of a bitch's reply after a long pause, during which the world's whole air hung there as if lifted and left to swing. Standing at the baseline, or walking back to the baseline to either serve or receive one of the two, I heard the client, his voice carried, and then, later, I heard my father's reply, may he rot in a green and empty hill. I heard what he said in reply, Sunbow, but not until after I'd fallen. I insist on this point, Jim. Not until after I'd started to fall. Jim, I'd been in the middle of trying to run down a ball way out of mortal reach, a rare, blind, lucky dribbler of a drop shot from the overgroomed locks across the net, a point I could have more than afforded to concede. But that's not the way a real player plays. With respect and due effort and care for every point. You want to be great? Near great, you give every ball everything, and then some. You concede nothing. Even against Loxes. You play right up to your limit and then pass your limit and look back at your former limit and wave a hanky at it, embarking. You enter a trance. You feel the seams and edges of everything. The court becomes an extremely unique place to be. It will do everything for you. It will let nothing escape your body. Objects move as they're made to, at the lightest, easiest touch.
You slip into the clear current of back and forth, making delicate X's and L's across the harsh, rough, bright green asphalt surface. Your sweat the same temperature as your skin, playing with such ease and total mindless, effortless effort and
entranced concentration. You don't even stop to consider whether to run down every ball. You're barely aware you're doing it. Your body's doing it for you, and the court and game's doing it for your body. You're barely involved. It's magic, boy. Nothing touches it when it's right. I predict it. Facts and figures and curved glass and those elbow-straining books of yours, lightless pages, are going to seem flat by comparison. Static. Dead and white and flat. They don't begin to... It's like a dance, Jim. The point is, I was too bodily respectful to slip up and fall on my own out there. And the other point is, I started to fall forward even before I started to hear him reply, standing there.
Yes, but he'll never be great.
What he said in no way made me fall forward. The unlovely opponent had dribbled one just barely over the too low public park net, a freak accident, a mishit drop shot, and another man on another court in another early round laugher would have let it dribble, conceded the affordable, not trying to wave a hanky from the vessel of his limit, not race on all eight healthy scarless cylinders desperately forward toward the net to try to catch the goddamn thing on the first bounce. Jim, but any man can slip.
I don't know what I slipped on, son.
There were spiders well known to infest the palms, fronds all along the court's fences. They come down at night on threads, bulbous, flexing. I'm thinking it could have been a bulbous, goo-filled widow I stepped and slipped on, Jim. A spider. A mad rogue spider come down on its thread into the shade, flabby and crawling, or that leapt suicidally right from an overhanging frond under the court, probably making a slight, flabby, hideous sound when it landed, crawling around on its claws, blinking grotesquely in the hot light it hated, that I stepped on, rushing forward and killed and slipped on the mess the big loathsome spider made. See these scars? all knotted and ragged, like something had torn at my own body's knees the way a slouching Brando would just rip a letter open with his teeth and let the envelope fall on the floor all wet and rent and torn. All the palms along the fence were sick. They had palm rot. It was the AD year 1933 of the great Bisbee palm rot epidemic. All through the state, and they were losing their fronds, and the fronds were blighted in the color of really old olives in those old, slim jars at the very back of the refrigerator, and exuded a sick sort of pus-like, slippery discharge, and sometimes abruptly fell from trees, curving back and forth through the air like celluloid pirates' paper swords. God, I hate fronds, Jim. I think it could have been either a daytime latrodectus or some pus from a frond. The wind blew cruddy pus from the web fronds under the court, maybe, up near the net. Either way, something poisonous, or infected at any rate, unexpected and slick. All it takes is a second, you're thinking, Jim. The body betrays you, and down you go, on your knees sliding on sandpaper court. Not so, son. I used to have another flask like this, smaller, a rather more cunning silver flask in the glove compartment of my Montclair. Your devoted mother did something to it. The subject has never been mentioned between us. Not so. It was a foreign body or a substance, not my body. And if anybody did any betraying that day, I'm telling you, sonny kid, boy, it was something I did, Jimmer. I may well have betrayed that fine, young, lithe, tan, unslumped body. I may very well have gotten rigid, overconscious, careless of it, listening for what my father, who I respected. I respected that man, Jim, is what's sick. I knew he was there. I was conscious of his flat face and filter's long shadow. I knew him, Jim. Things were different when I was growing up, Jim. I hate to, Jesus. I hate saying something like this. This things were different when I was a lad type cliche shit, the sort of cliche fathers back then spouted, assuming he said anything at all. But it was different. Our kids, my generation's kids, they, now you, this post-Brando crowd, you new kids, can't like us or dislike us or respect us or not as human beings, Jim. Your parents, no, wait, you don't have to pretend you disagree. Don't, you don't have to say it, Jim, because I know it. I could have predicted it, watching Brando and Dean and the rest, and I know it, so don't splutter. I blame no one your age, boyo. You see, parents as kind or unkind, or happy or miserable, or drunk or sober, or great or near great, or failed the way you see a table square or a Montclair lip red. Kids today, you kids today somehow don't know how to feel, much less love, to say nothing of respect. We're just bodies to you. We're just bodies and shoulders and scarred knees and big bellies and empty wallets and flasks to you. I'm not saying something cliche like you take us for granted so much as I'm saying you cannot imagine our absence. We're so present, it ceased to mean. We're environmental, furniture of the world. Jim, I could imagine that man's absence. Jim, I'm telling you, you cannot imagine my absence. It's my fault, Jim. Home so much, limping around, ruined knees, overweight, under the influence, burping, non-slim, sweat-soaked in that broiler of a trailer, burping, farting, frustrated, miserable, knocking lamps over, overshooting my reach. Afraid to give my last talent the one shot it demanded. Talent is its own expectation, Jim. You either live up to it, or it waves a hanky, receding forever. Use it or lose it, he'd say over the newspaper. I'm just afraid of having a tombstone that says, here lies a promising old man. It's
potential may be worse than none, Jim. There's no talent to fritter in the first place. Lying around guzzling because I haven't the balls to... God, I'm so sorry, Jim. You don't deserve to see me like this. And I'm so scared, Jim. I'm so scared of dying without ever being really seen. Can you understand? Are you enough of a big, thin, prematurely stooped, young, bespectacled man, even with your whole life still ahead of you, to understand?
Can you see I was giving it all I had? That I was in there, out there in the heat, listening, webbed with nerves? A self that touches all edges, I remember, she said.
I felt it in a way I fear you and your generation never could, son. It was less like falling than being shot out of something, is the way I recall it. It did not happen in slow motion.
1 minute I was at a dead and beautiful forward run for the ball. The next minute there were hands at my back and nothing underfoot like a push down a stairway.
A rude whiplashing shove square in the back, and my promising body with all its webs of nerves pulsing and firing was in full airborne flight and came down on my knees.
This flask is empty. Right down on my knees. With all my weight and inertia on that scabrous, hot sandpaper surface, forced into what was an exact parody of an imitation of contemplative prayer, sliding forward.
The flesh and the tissue and bone left twin tracks of brown, red, gray, white, like tire tracks of bodily gore extending from the service line to the net. I slid on my flaming knees, rushed past the dribbling ball and toward the net that ended my slide. Our slide. My racket had gone pinwheeling off, Jim, and my racketless arms out before me, sliding, Jim, in the attitude of a mortified monk in total prayer. It was given me to hear my father pronounce my bodily existence as not even potentially great. At the moment, I ruined my knees forever, Jim. So that even years later at USC, I never got to wave my hanky at anything beyond the near and almost great and would have been great if, and later could never even hope to audition for those swim trunk and Brill Cream beach movies that Snake Avalon is making his mint on. I do not insist that the judgment and punishing fall were connected, Jim. Any man can slip out there. All it takes is a second of misplaced respect. Son, it was more than a father's voice carrying. My mother cried out. It was a religious moment. I learned what it means to be a body, Jim, just meat wrapped in a sort of flimsy nylon stocking, son, as I fell, kneeling, and slid toward the stretched net, myself seen by me, frame by frame, torn open. I may have to burp. Belch, son. Son. Telling you what I learned, son. My love. Too late. As I left my knees meet behind me, slid, ended in a posture of supplication on my knees, disclosed bones, with my fingers racketless hooked through the mesh of the net, across which the net, the sopped dandy had dropped his pricey gut-strung Davis racket and was running toward me with his visor askew and his hands to his cheeks. My father and the client he was there to perform for dragged me upright to the palm's infected shade where she knelt, on the plaid beach blanket with her knuckles between her teeth, Jim. And I felt the religion of the physical that day. And not much more in your age, Jim.
She was filling with blood.
Held under the arms by two bodies big as yours and dragged off a public court with two extra lines.
It's a pivotal.
It's a seminal religious day. When you get to both hear and feel your destiny at the same moment, Jim. I got to notice what I'm sure you've noticed long ago. I know, and I know you've seen me brought home on occasions. Dragged in the door under what's called the influence, son. Helped in by cabbies at night. I've seen your long shadow grotesquely backlit at the top of the house's stairs I helped pay for, boy. How the drunk and the maimed both are dragged forward out of the arena like a boneless Christ, one man under each arm, feet dragging, eyes on the ether. The 4th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. From Cambridge's Latinate Inman Square, Michael Pemulis, nobody's fool at all, rides one necessary bus to Central Square and then an unnecessary bus to Davis Square and a train back to Central. This is to throw off the slightest possible chance of pursuit. At Central, he catches the red line to Park Street Station, where he's parked the tow truck in an underground lot he can more than afford. The day is autumnal and mild, the east breeze smelling of urban commerce and the vague suede smell of new fallen leaves. The sky is pilot light blue. Sunlight reflects complexly off the smoked glass sides of tall centers of commerce all around Park Street downtown. Pemulis wears buttonfly chinos and an ETA shirt beneath a snazzy blue Brioni sport coat, plus the bright white yachting cap that Mario Incandenza calls his Mr. Howell hat. The hat looks rakish even when turned around, and it has a detachable lining. Inside the lining can be kept portable quantities of just about anything. Having indulged in 150 milligrams of very mild dreams, post-transaction. Wearing also gray and blue saddle oxfords without socks, it's such a mild autumn day. The streets literally bustle. Vendors with carts instead of tubs sell hot pretzels and tonics and those underboiled franks Pemulis likes to have them put the works on. You can see the State House and Common and Courthouse and Public Gardens, and beyond all that, the cool, smooth facades of Back Bay brownstones. The echoes in the underground Park Place garage, park, gark, 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 are pleasantly complex. Traffic westward on Commonwealth Avenue is light, meaning things can move, all the way through Kenmore Square and past Boston U and up the long, slow hill into Alston and Enfield. When Tavis and Stitt and the players and ground crew and Testar and ATH-SCME teams inflate the all-weather lung for the winter over courts 16 through 32, the domed lung's nacelle is visible against the horizon all the way down by the Brighton Avenue-Commonwealth Avenue split in Lower Alston. The incredibly potent DMZ is apparently classed as a paramethoxylated amphetamine, but really it looks to Pemulis, from his slow and tortured survey of the MedCom's monographs, more similar to the anticholinergic deliriant class. Way more powerful than mescaline, or MDA, or DMA, or TMA, or MDMA, or DOM, or STP, or the IV ingestible DMT, or Olaluki, or Datura's scopolamine, or fluothane, or bufotenine, aka Jackie O, or ebene, or psilocybin, or Sylert.
56.
DMZ resembling chemically some miscegenation of a lysergic with a mesimeloid, but significantly different from LSD-25 in that its effects are less visual and spatially cerebral, and more like temporally cerebral, and almost ontological, with some sort of manipulated phenylkylamine-like speediness whereby the ingester perceives his relation to the ordinary flow of time as radically, and euphorically, is where the mesimal affective resemblance shows its head, altered.
57.
The incredibly potent DMZ is synthesized from a derivative of Fitvayavi, an obscure mold that grows only on other molds, by the same ambivalently lucky chemist at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, who'd first stumbled on LSD as a relatively ephebic and clueless organic chemist while futzing around with ergotic fungi on rye. DMZ's discovery was the tail end of the BS 1960s, just about the same time Dr. Alan Watts was considering T. Leary's invitation to become writer-in-resonance at Leary's utopian LSD 25 colony in Millbrook, New York, on what is now Canadian soil. A substance even just the accidental synthesis of which sent the Sandoz chemist into early retirement and serious, unblinking wall-watching. The incredibly potent DMZ has a popular lay chemical underground reputation as the single grimmest thing ever conceived in a tube. It is also now the hardest recreational compound to acquire in North America after raw Vietnamese opium, which, forget it. DMZ is sometimes also referred to in some Metro Boston chemical circles as Madam Psychosis, after a popular very early morning cult radio personality on MIT's student-run radio station WYYY 109, largest whole prime on the FM band, which Mario Incandenza and ETA Stats Weenie and Eschaton Game Master Otis P. Lord listened to almost religiously. The day shift Ennett House kid at the booth who raises the portcullis to let him onto the grounds had a couple times in October approached Pemulus about a potential transaction. Pemulus has a rigid policy about not transacting with ETA employees who come up the hill from the halfway house, since he knows some of them are at the place on court order and knows for a fact they pull unscheduled urines all over the place down there. And types like the Ennett House types are just the sorts of people Pemulus's talents let him get away from in terms of, like, social milieu and mixing and transacting. And his basic attitude with these low-rent employees is one of unfoolish discretion and, like, why tempt fate? The East courts are empty and ball-strewn when Pemulus pulls in. Most of them are still at lunch. Pemulus, Trolch, and Schacht's triple room is in subdorm B in the back north part of the second floor of West House, and so superjacent to the dining hall, from which, through the floor, Pemulus can hear voices and silverware and can smell exactly what they're having. The first thing he does is boot up the phone console and try Ink and Mario's room over in ComAd, where Hal is sitting in window light with the Riverside Hamlet he told Mario he'd read and help with a conceptual film-type project based on part of his uncushioned captain's chair, partly under an old print of a detail from the minor and softcore Alexandrian mosaic Consummation of the Leverets, eating an Amino Pal energy bar and waiting very casually, the phone with its antenna already out lying ready on the arm of the chair, and two folio-sized Barron's SAT prep guides and a spine-shot copy of the BS 1937, Tilden on Spin, and his keys on their neck chain lying on the Lindisfarne carpet by his shoe, waiting in a very casual posture. Hal deliberately waits till the audio console's third ring, like a girl at home on Saturday night. Mielo? The turd emergeth, Pemulus's clear and digitally condensed voice on the line. Repeat, the turd emergeth. Please commit a crime, is Hal Incandenza's immediate reply. Gracious me, Pemulus says into the phone tucked under his jaw, carefully de-velcroing the lining of his Mr. Howell hat. Tennis and the Feral Prodigy, narrated by Hal Incandenza. An 11.5-minute digital entertainment cartridge, directed, recorded, edited, and, according to the entry form, written by Mario Incandenza, in receipt of New England Regional Honorable Mention in Interlace Tell Entertainment's annual New Eyes, New Voices Young Filmmakers Contest. April, in the year of the You Shit You, 2007, Mimetic Resolution Cartridge View Motherboard, easy to install upgrade for Infernitron Interlace TP systems for home, office, or mobile. Almost exactly 3 years after Dr. James O. Incandenza passed from this life. Here is how to put on a big red tent of a shirt that has ETA across the chest in gray. Please ease carefully into your supporter and adjust the elastic straps so the straps do not bite into your butt and make bulged ridges in your butt that everyone can see once you've sweated through your shorts. Here is how to wrap your torn ankle so tightly in its flesh-tone ace bandages, your left leg feels like a log. Here is how to win later. This is a yellow iron mesh ball hopper full of dirty green dead old balls. Take them to the east courts while the dawn is still chalky and no one's around except the morning doves that infest the pines at sunrise, and the air is so sopped you can see your summer breath. It serves to no one. Make a mess of balls along the base of the opposite fence as the sun hauls itself up over the harbor, and a thin sweat breaks and the serves start to boom. Stop thinking and let it flow and go boom, boom. The shiver off the ball against the opposite fence. Hit about 1,000 serves to no one while himself sits and advises with his flask. Older men's legs are white and hairless from decades in pants. Here is a set of keys astride's length before you in the court as you serve dead balls to no one. After each serve, you must almost fall forward into the court, and in one smooth motion bend and scoop up the keys with your left hand. This is how to train yourself to follow through into the court after the serve. You still, years after the man's death, cannot keep your keys anywhere but on the floor. This is how to hold the stick. Learn to call the racket a stick. Everyone does here. It's a tradition. The stick. Something so much an extension of you deserves a sobriquet. Please look. You'll be shown exactly once how to hold it. This is how to hold it. Just like this. Forget all the Near Eastern slice backhand grip baffle gab. Just say hello is all. Just shake hands with the calfskin grip of the stick. This is how to hold it. The stick is your friend. You will become very close. Grasp your friend firmly at all times. A firm grip is essential for both control and power. Here is how to carry a tennis ball around in your stick hand, squeezing it over and over for long stretches of time. In class, on the phone, in lab, in front of the TP, a wet ball for the shower, ideally squeezing it at all times except during meals. See the Academy dining hall, where tennis balls sit beside every plate. Squeeze the tennis ball rhythmically month after year until you feel it no more than your heart squeezing blood and your right forearm is 3 times the size of your left and your arm looks from across a court like a gorilla's arm or a stevedore's arm pasted on the body of a child. Here is how to do extra individual drills before the Academy's AM drills, before breakfast, so that after the 1,000th ball hit just out of reach by himself, with his mammoth wingspan and ghastly calves, urging you with nothing but smiles on to great and greater demonstrations of effort, so that after you've gotten your 3rd and final wind and must vomit, there is little inside to vomit, and the spasms pass quickly, and an east breeze blows cooler past you and you feel clean and can breathe. Here is how to don red and gray ETA sweats and squad jog a weekly 40-kilometer up and down urban Commonwealth Avenue, even though you would rather set your hair on fire than jog in a pack. Jogging is painful and pointless, but you are not in charge. Your brother gets to ride shotgun while a senile German blows BBs at your legs, both of them laughing and screaming, "Schnell!" Enfield is due east of the marathon's hills of heartbreak, which are just up Commonwealth, past the reservoir in Newton. Urban jogging in a sweaty pack is tedious. Half himself hunched down to put a long pale arm around your shoulders and tell you that his own father had told him that talent is sort of a dark gift. The talent is its own expectation. It is there from the start and either lived up to or lost. Have a father whose own father lost what was there. Have a father who lived up to his own promise and then found thing after thing to meet and surpass the expectations of his promise in, and didn't seem just a whole hell of a lot happier or tighter wrapped than his own failed father, leaving you yourself in a kind of feral and flux-ridden state with respect to talent. Here is how to avoid thinking about any of this by practicing and playing until everything runs on autopilot and talent's unconscious exercise becomes a way to escape yourself, a long waking dream of pure play. The irony is that this makes you very good, and you start to become regarded as having a prodigious talent to live up to. Here is how to handle being a feral prodigy. Here is how to handle being seated at tournaments, signifying that seating committees composed of old, big-armed men publicly expect you to reach a certain round. Reaching at least the round you're supposed to is known at tournaments as justifying your seed. By repeating this term over and over, perhaps in the same rhythm at which you squeeze a ball, you can reduce it to an empty series of phonemes, just formants and fricatives, trochaically stressed, signifying zip. Here is how to beat unseeded, wide-eyed opponents from Iowa or Rhode Island in the early rounds of tournaments without expending much energy, but also without seeming contemptuous. This is how to play with personal integrity in a tournament's early rounds when there is no umpire. Any ball that lands on your side and is too close to call, call it fair. Here is how to be invulnerable to gamesmanship, to keep your attention's aperture tight. Here is how to teach yourself when an opponent maybe cheats on the line calls, to remind yourself that what goes around comes around, that a poor sport's punishment is always self-inflicted. Try to learn to let what is unfair teach you. Here is how to spray yourself down exactly once with Lemon Pledge, the ultimate sunscreen, then discover that when you go out and sweat into it, it smells like close-order skunk. Here is how to take non-narcotic muscle relaxants for the back spasms that come from thousands of serves to no one. Here is how to weep in bed trying to remember when your torn blue ankle didn't hurt every minute. This is the whirlpool, a friend. Here is how to set up the electric ball machine at dawn on the days himself is away, living up to what will be his final talent. Here is how to tie a bow tie. Here is how to sit through small openings of your father's first art films, surrounded by surly foreign cigarette smoke and conversations so pretentious you literally cannot believe them. You're sure you have misheard them. Pretend you're engaged by the jagged angles and multiple exposures without pretending you have the slightest idea what's going on. Assume your brother's expression. Here is how to sweat. Here is how to hand a trophy to lateral Alice Moore to put in the ETA lobby's glass case under its system of spotlights and small signs. What is unfair can be a stern but invaluable teacher. Here is how to pack carbohydrates into your tissues for a 4 singles, 2 doubles match day in a Florida June. Please learn to sleep with perpetual sunburn. Expect some rough dreams. They come with the territory. Try to accept them. Let them teach you. Keep a flashlight by your bed. It helps with the dreams. Please make no extramural friends. Discourage advances from outside the circuit. Turn down dates. If you do exactly the rehabilitative exercises they assign you, no matter how silly and tedious, the ankle will mend more quickly. This type of stretch helps prevent the groin pull. Treat your knees and elbow with all reasonable care. You will have them with you for a long time. Here is how to turn down an extramural date so you won't be asked again.
Say something like, I'm terribly sorry, I can't come out to see 8½ revived on a wall-size Cambridge Celluloid Festival viewer on Friday, Kimberly,
or Daphne, but you see, if I jump rope for 2 hours, then jog backwards through Newton till I puke, they'll let me watch match cartridges, and then my mother will read aloud to me from the OED until 2200 lights out, and see. So you can be sure that henceforth, Daphne, Kimberly, Jennifer will take her adolescent mating dance type ritual socialization business somewhere else. Be on guard. The road widens and many of the detours are seductive. Be constantly focused and on alert. Feral talent is its own set of expectations and can abandon you at any one of the detours of so-called normal American life at any time. So be on guard. Here is how to schnell. Here is how to go through your normal adolescent growth spurt and have every limb in your body ache like a migraine because selected groups of muscles have been worked until thick and intensile, and they resist as the sudden growth of bone tries to stretch them, and they ache all the time. There is medication for this condition. If you are an adolescent, here is the trick to being neither quite a nerd nor quite a jock. Be no one. It is easier than you think. Here is how to read the monthly ETA and USTA and ONANTA rankings the way himself read scholars' reviews of his multiple exposure melodramas. Learn to care and not to care. They mean the rankings to help you determine where you are, not who you are. Memorize your monthly rankings and forget them. Here is how. Never tell anyone where you are. This is also how not to fear sleep or dreams. Never tell anyone where you are. Please, learn the pragmatics of expressing fear. Sometimes words that seem to express really invoke. This can be tricky. Here is how to get free sticks and strings and clothes and gear from Dunlop Incorporated, as long as you let them spray paint the distinctive Dunlop logo on your sticks, strings, and so logos on your shoulder, and the left pocket of your shorts, and use a Dunlop gear bag, and you become a walking, lunging, sweating advertisement for Dunlop Incorporated. This is all as long as you keep justifying your seed and preserving your rank. The Dunlop Incorporated New England Regional Athletic Rep will address you as Our Gray Swan. He wears designer slacks and choking cologne, and about twice a year wants to help you dress, and has to be slapped like a gnat. Be a student of the game. Like most cliches of sport, this is profound. You can be shaped, or you can be broken. There is not much in between. Try to learn. Be coachable. Try to learn from everybody, especially those who fail. This is hard. Peers who fizzle, or blow up, or fall down, run away, disappear from the monthly rankings, drop off the circuit. ETA peers waiting for DeLint to knock quietly at their door and ask to chat. Opponents. It's all educational. How promising you are as a student of the game is a function of what you can pay attention to without running away. Nets and fences can be mirrors. And between the nets and fences, opponents are also mirrors. This is why the whole thing is scary. This is why all opponents are scary, and weaker opponents are especially scary. See yourself in your opponents. They will bring you to understand the game, to accept the fact that the game is about managed fear, that its object is to send from yourself what you hope will not return. This is your body. They want you to know. You will have it with you, always. On this issue, there is no counsel. You must make your best guess. For myself, I do not expect ever really to know. But in the interval, if it is an interval, Here is Motrin for your joints, Noxema for your burn, Lemon Pledge if you prefer nausea to burn, Contracol for your back,